Thank you. So I'm quite excited about this workshop. I started working in this field over 5 years ago now. And although I've met some of you before, this is the first dedicated meeting which I attend, and I'm looking forward to meeting many others. I should mention my collaborators, Misha Smolkin, the organizer, and Michelle Levy. Both of them are here present, and they were my students. I would like to thank the organizers for their efforts, work, and their leadership, and especially Rob Myers, is here, here, for the initiative and vision to make this meeting happen. So this is going to be an unusual talk. There is no PowerPoint presentation and maybe even very little Blackboard. We'll see how it goes. This is just the way it worked out. It wanted to be written. So in general, in physics, we try to address problems which are interesting both from an experimental point of view and theoretically. In our case, the morning talks explained very well the observational or experimental motivations. And these are very interesting and important, but I will concentrate on the theoretical interest, which I think is also intrinsically interesting. So I'm going to try and make an overview of the whole field. You know, in the Jewish tradition, once a year on Yom Kippur, you try to reflect back on the year that passed and to think about the coming year. So I will try to go over the developments that we had in the field and maybe to end with some open questions. It's a tall order, of course, and we'll see how it comes out.
I didn't hear, what are we atoning for?
We're not atoning for. Well, this is also a tradition. Usually people expect others to atone, and this is also a tradition. Yes, exactly.
Wait, isn't that a form of atonement?
Yes. This is classical. Okay, so the story that I want to tell you starts close to 20 years ago when I took a quantum field theory course. Actually, it was so interesting that I took it twice, once in Tel Aviv with Kobi Sonnenschein and Shimon Yankelevich, and then a second time in Stanford with Renata Kalosh with a textbook with drafts that would later turn into the book by Peskin and Schroeder. And as I was taking the course, I was constantly worried about several questions, which I want to share with you. Perhaps nobody was bothered by these questions. Perhaps others knew the answers, and perhaps both of the possibilities. But I was constantly worried. Each concept, there were many new concepts. The concepts were the Lorentz group, relativistic fields and particles, propagators, the path integral, Feynman diagrams, generating functions and effective action, spinner fields, vector fields, and the associated gauge fixing terms, ghosts, and the deepest of all, renormalization, and many, many others. And while I was studying, I was constantly asking myself, what is the natural or simplest context to introduce each one of these concepts? And in particular, which one of these concepts is inherently quantum and which one is classical. And in a way, much of the work that already we started describing, and Chad talked a moment ago, just completed one missing block from this construction, is to realize the classical analog of many concepts that by historical accidents were discovered only in quantum field theory, but are really, there's nothing quantum about them. They're completely classical. They could have been invented much before that. They should have been invented maybe if people had treated seriously the two-body problem in GR or the two-body problem in electromagnetism or other classical problems. But never we needed the high accuracies maybe. So to go, namely going to higher loops, higher orders of perturbation theory. This was never needed. So somehow it was invented only with quantum field theory, and now we're trying to disentangle and understand what is essentially classical and what is quantum. So here are some questions that I was concerned about. We have the path integral. So I don't know, we define. We define everything through a path integral, but the path integral, we know how to manipulate it maybe, but we know that it's not well defined. So it's a bit, I think till this day, there is some perhaps cause of concern. Second thing is that the basic thing that we learn in a perturbative quantum field theory course is to draw and compute quantum Feynman diagrams. So here is some scattering experiment. And we need to know the values of the various things that appear here. For instance, the propagator may be I over k squared plus I epsilon for the Feynman propagator. And there would be a vertex. And I was concerned by several things. First, we know that that tree diagrams are classical, but it's not always very manifest the way you work with it. And today, we know from our point of view that in classical physics, there are loops, but only classical loops. The quantum loops are not allowed, but the classical loops are allowed. There are factors of I all over the place. While if we want to take a classical limit, then everything should be real. The factors of H bar, on the other hand, are often not very visible. So it also could be a bit troubling. They can be retraced, but it is a bit troubling. What else was I worried about? OK, one more example could be the gauge fixing term that we need to use in gauge theories. And then so we're familiar with the Lorentz gauge, but in quantum physics, we also have an additional parameter. And you ask yourself, what is the physical interpretation of this parameter? And Peskin and Schroeder suggest to you that is some kind of standard deviation that you have to use when you average in the path integral, because all of this will go into the exponent. It looks like some standard deviation for an average of all these path integral values. But that sounds weird because it looks classical. And you use it for tree diagrams also. So how do you classically interpret this value, this xi parameter, for instance? OK. So this is a selection of questions. After taking field theory, I worked on several topics. I first started with black holes in string theory for a few years. Then I worked on supersymmetric field theories, the concepts of PQ webs, for those who know it. And then I shifted fields again, and I worked on phase transitions in general relativity, mostly the black hole, black string transition associated with the Gregory Laflamme instability. And then we get to number two on our outline, the breakthrough. One day in September 2004, I read on the archive a paper by this gentleman, Goldberger and Rothstein here. And they seem to do very nice things. They use Feynman diagrams to compute the first relativistic corrections to the Newtonian motion, to gravity. Well, first they start by separating scales. They look at the binary motion. They divide it into potential modes and radiation modes. They make some a hierarchy of scales. Then they go on to compute the first relativistic or first post-Newtonian correction. They have a renormalization example. But I have to admit, I didn't fully understand it. So I said, that's very interesting. And it was there on the side. Where it really, when it really clicked to me was in February 2006. Then came out another paper of Chu, Goldberger, and Rothstein, where they studied the problem of caged black holes. So let me just tell you what caged black holes are. If you consider a model with an extra dimension, so this is a compact dimension periodic, then you can consider black holes which are smaller than the extra dimension. So we call them caged black holes. And they are part of the phase diagram of the Gregory-Laflamme instability. And using the effective filter approach, they were able to compute the thermodynamics of the system, a problem that I was also interested, actually, together with Dan Gorbonos. I had two papers on the subject. And after much work, using the concept of matched asymptotic expansion, we were able to compute to one loop, so to next to leading corrections, the thermodynamics, while they, with a few Feynman diagrams, were able to go to two loops. So of course, when somebody does something that you're really working on, then you cannot ignore it, and you understand it, and you see how interesting it is. And actually, we were able to slightly improve the calculation. And in the end, the two loop amounted to a computation of a single Feynman diagram, which I can now draw, which was actually decomposable, factorizable, and trivial to compute. This represents the small black hole. This represents the Newtonian potential. And that's the only computation that you really need to do within this method. So I became a true believer in the strength of this method and its ability to give you insight and enhance computation. Although in principle, it's not different than usual matched asymptotic expansion, but it somehow applies all the standard technology of quantum field theories. So it's very strong. I'm not sure how you got to work on this subject. Okay.
I think. I don't remember.
So I should. Okay, good. So I should continue citing people. Okay. Yes. So that was a point of a transformation, and then, but there were things that were bothering me still about this IFT approach, and the thing that bothered me relate to the questions that I described before. The paper, the first paper, was still full of path integrals. It was full of I's. It was full of H bars through the Planck mess. And I wanted to clean that. I thought, if you want to do complicated things, you should first understand the simple things. And then the complicated things become easy also. So I started asking, so I have answers to some of these, of the questions that I posed before. And the first question I want to ask is, when are we supposed to use this tool? Okay, so this meeting is on classical effective field theories, or equivalently perturbative classical field theories. But when does one use them? And Chad actually answered this question in his review. He said, when you have a hierarchy of scales, I think I can even sharpen that. You need to have a hierarchy of length or time scales. Nothing else. So let's see. Basically, you need to have two things. So far, I'm calling them R0 and L, two length scales. And they need to be widely separated. So let's see how this definition applies to the usual cases that we know. So first case that is the central example is the post-Newtonian. The post-Newtonian is defined limit as the case where all the velocities are much smaller than 1. Now, how is that related to two small length scales? By the virial theorem, of course, we know that this is roughly R0, the size, the typical size of the black holes, divided by their separation. Okay? So now we can equivalently interpret this limit as the limit where the black holes, the scale of the Schwarzschild radius, is much smaller than the scale of the separation. The next perturbative limit, which applies to the binary system, to the two-body problem in Einstein's gravity, is the extreme S ratio. Okay, so we have one mass, small m, which is much smaller than capital M. And in this case, it looks like it's masses which are in a hierarchy, but actually I claim that it's, again, length scale, because M is nothing but R0 over 2, the Schwarzschild radius of the small object, and capital M is capital R0 over 2, which gives us the picture of a small object moving in the background of the Schwarzschild or black hole metric of the other object. So again, we have a separation of scales. Another well-known example from undergraduate physics is the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. If you remember, there we, in atomic quantum atomic physics, there we want to study a molecule, and we have there two timescales. We have the fast electrons, which we solve assuming that the nuclei are static, and then we have the motion of the slow nuclei, which we solve assuming some effective interactions or averaged interactions that come from the cloud of the electrons. So this notion, this Born-Oppenheimer approximation, is actually another example where we have two scales. Here in the Born-Oppenheimer example, it's not a field theory, it's a mechanics or a quantum mechanics. You have just the time direction. So there are two times. So the electron time is much shorter than the nucleon time, and it's the same idea. So that's for the domain of validity of this system. The next observation was the connection between matched asymptotic expansion and the effective field theory. So I want to explain that. What is matched asymptotic expansion? In matched asymptotic expansion, it's a well-known technique in differential equations. According to Damour, it goes back at least to Laplace, who tried to use that to solve the shape of water droplets on a table. And you okay, no comment. I have to remind you that we are recorded. So how would it work for the post-Newtonian case? In the post-Newtonian case, there would be several zones. So there would be a black hole zone in which the Schwarzschild radius is of finite length, but the separation is infinite, so we don't see it. This zone, actually, we will not use in practice. Then there would be a second zone where the separation is finite, but the sizes are infinitesimal, and the wavelength of the radiation is now infinite because R0 is much smaller than R, actually by 2 powers of V. And finally, there is a radiation zone. So this is the system zone, if you like. And here there's a radiation zone where the whole system is just one point, and we see sprinkling waves coming out of it, and the wavelength lambda is finite. So this would have been the standard way to solve the problem. Why is it called matched asymptotic expansion? In each one of them, you solve the equations, but for each one of them, you don't have enough boundary conditions. For instance, for these guys, you don't have the boundary conditions both at infinity and close to the objects. And then you obtain the boundary conditions from the other zones. And there's a nice dialogue where each time you solve one of the zones, found a solution, and then you export it to another zone as a boundary condition and use that to find another solution. So that's the matching of the asymptotics, matched asymptotic expansion. There is a very nice analog, by the way, in numerical methods. What's the name in numerical methods of this matched asymptotic expansion? It is called adaptive grids, right? If we have this problem numerically, then what we will do, we will draw the two black holes, and then our grid would be very dense close to the black holes, many points, less dense in this region, and even less dense far away. So there would be just one grid, but it would have variable density, and in a way it would mimic the density of the grid, mimics the fact that we really have maybe three zones or sometimes two zones of importance, and this is mimicked by the adaptive grid. Now we know that the effective field theory is again equivalent to this. How is it equivalent? It's equivalent in the way that the potential modes, H mu nu, represent actually the near zone. So because they have, because their length scale is R, they really describe for us the system zone. While the radiation zone, which are denoted by H bar, but it's not the quantum H bar nor the general relativistic H bar, so maybe it should be called H radiation, that really applies to the modes that live in the radiation zone. So instead of speaking of different zones, in the effective field theory language, we speak of different modes, but that's actually the same. Okay, what else? So we had there several things that bothered us, and now we can replace them by classical analogs. I don't know if either one is deep, but it gives us a satisfying physical picture. So instead of the path integral definition, we use just a classical definition for the effective action, the same one that we would get from the saddle point approximation in quantum physics, namely that we just have to evaluate the action on a solution. So S effective, suppose we want to compute the two-body action, then S effective as a function of the locations, we have to take the full action and evaluate it on any trajectory, not necessarily a solution, and compute the metric given these trajectories and evaluate them on S. This is a definition of S effective. So from now on, we don't need to use the path integral anymore. We have a definition which is necessary and sufficient or whatever for all the uses. Now, what about the Feynman rules? So we can get rid of all H bars and I's, and you can see already by habit, first I would always write here P because I was used to quantum field theory, and then I started using always K. So okay, so in quantum field theory, it's the momentum here that I should write. Okay, so how does it work in classical physics? In classical physics, we always have to take 1 over the quadratic action. If the quadratic action is an operator, we should invert the operator. And that means that in the usual case, it becomes minus 1 over k squared. Now I'm using k, the wave number, not the momentum, because that's related by h bar, but we don't have h bar. And there is no I. And a vertex is just what you have in the action, so it will be just minus m dt in this case. Again, because the action is real, then all the vertices are real. So now all of these are real. And where does the H bar come from? Well, so now we can try to formulate quantum mechanics in this language. Suppose I want to do quantum mechanics, quantum field theory with these Feynman rules instead of with those Feynman rules. Then I have to add just one more rule. I can do it consistently this way. I have to add only one rule, and the rule is that whenever there's a loop, I have to associate with it the prefactor that comes in front of the action. So in quantum mechanics, it's IH bar. So I have to invent one more rule for each loop. I need an IH bar, okay? So now all the I's and all the H bars are fully explicit, but without quantum loops, the propagators and the vertices are free of I's and are free of H bars. Yes?
In, so the quantum
picture, you get finite diagrams because of the big expansion of the exponential.
Yes, good question.
So what tells you that diagrams replace the solution inside the action, I mean, without going through the quantity?
Excellent. Yes, this is something that I skipped. So indeed, when we study quantum field theory, we are told that these lines all represent particles. And particles, obviously, are quantum notions. So what we understand now is that, at least in the classical limit, we should think of each line as representing a field. So it's a representation of the field. And it turns out that if you try to compute the effective action, you can do it by first finding a solution, then substituting back into the action and evaluating. But then you have several terms, all of the same form. And when you sum all of them up, it's just equal to the Feynman diagram. So the Feynman diagram is a smart mathematical mechanism that does some sort of combinatorics and gives you everything at one point and together. Actually, we know how to prove it in the quantum case using the path integral, that you should use the Feynman diagrams. For the classical case, the proof is not complete yet, as far as I understand. Okay, so you would like to have a completely classical proof of this fact.
Somebody's doing it?
I know it up to some questions, so we can discuss it later if you wish. Okay, so now, of course, when you look at these rules, they look very similar to those. And you may say, okay, it is trivial. I just multiplied something by I and divided something by I. And it's really hard, and I don't wish to argue issues of triviality, but it's reminiscent of the story of Columbus's egg. So hopefully there's someone in the audience who doesn't know this story, and I will have to tell it. Is there anybody in the audience who doesn't know the story? Okay, excellent. So Columbus comes back from the trip to where he discovered America, and he gives a talk in the Geographical Society, let's say in Spain. And then, as a custom, they take him to dinner with the speaker. And then one of the person says, look, it's trivial what you did. Obviously, if you go with S, you will discover something. It's trivial. So Columbus says, okay, and my friend, we're now at dinner. Each one of us has a hard-boiled egg. Let's see if you can make it stand on its thin tip. So everybody's trying, and it's all the time falling. They're trying to balance, and they leave it, and it always falls. And then they tell him, look, you gave us a problem with no solution. He says, no, there is a solution. He takes the eggs, and he punches it into the table, and it gets flat, and then it stands perfectly well. So everybody says, hey, that's not fair. We thought that was not within the rules. Okay? And Columbus says, that's exactly the point. So I'm not saying that this is the analogy, but but it is true. But it is true that I'm not saying that, okay? But it is true that I don't know if anybody suggested it beforehand. So sometimes something is very simple, but I think it clarifies a lot if you have it, if you have it.
Get the principal value, because the imaginary part is also there.
Okay, good. So Gerard's question. Gerard's question applies to the question of which propagator are we using. Because there we use the Feynman propagator, but obviously that's a quantum notion. So which propagator should we be using here? And then there was, and maybe up to less than an hour ago, there was a confusion. Should we use the retarded propagator, the even propagator, and so on? And I think now after the last talk, I think the thing's clarified, so we know exactly which propagators we should be using in classical field theory. So you see, this is very recent progress. Now, regarding the gauge fixing term, which I mentioned before, there's also a very simple classical interpretation to this term. We find that we need to use it when we do computations, and the interpretation is simply that when we look at the equations of motion, we need to add to them multiples of the constraints. That's how we use the gauge constraints, by adding multiples. And this gauge fixing parameter tells us which multiple of the gauge constraint we should add to the equations of motion. So we really need this information. When we do classical physics, we don't need only to know what is the constraint, but with what multiple we wish to add it to each equation of motion, and that's the data that is supplied by disk C. Okay, so that's for generalities about a classical limit of a field theorem. And now let's look a bit in more detail what we already started to do, to look into the post-Newtonian problem. So this is, of course, a problem that goes way back. From the moment that GR was invented by Einstein, he wanted to know what was the Newtonian limit. In 1938, he found, actually, the first relativistic correction together with Infeld and Hoffman, and it was a lot of work for them. Actually, it was so much work that the paper was 38 long without the calculations. The calculations themselves were so long that they said they cannot have any intrinsic values in their own, any intrinsic value of their own, and they simply deposited them with the secretary of the Institute for Advanced Study, which is the current analog for putting it on the internet. Okay, so that's in 1938. And later, Infeld was Einstein's student. Yes, I heard that. But so why did Einstein work so hard?
The method was very complicated, using surface integrals surrounding the two bodies, and at that time.
So you wanted to confirm it by another method, you mean?
No, Lorentz and Rost used standard post-Newtonian of Hartmann. Was going to be.
My question is, why did Einstein work so hard 20 years later if it was already known?
Yes, but I think that he didn't know the result by Rost.
Okay,
fine.
So then, Infeld in Poland and Fock in Russia continued this school in the 50s. There was a school, and there still is maybe in Japan, Kimura et al., I believe. And of course, already for some 30 years, the wonderful work by Damour, Blanchet, Schaeffer are here. And we're using what now I will call traditional methods to solve the two-body problem. So how are we going to analyze it in the effective field theory approach? Okay, so let's free some space. So here are the two bodies, and we have the v squared as we just wrote before. Each velocity is much smaller than the speed of light, or that the separation is much larger than each quartic radius. And we want to find now the ensuing motion and the radiation which will be emitted from the system. That's the exercise or the objective of the problem. And the way it is solved is that we, we start by writing that the action is nothing but the Einstein-Hilbert, the full Einstein-Hilbert action. And in this picture, we imagine the two black holes to really be black holes with horizons and everything. But then the idea of the effective field theory is to replace, of course, the black holes by point particles. And actually, we're going beyond the point particle approximation because we're going to compute corrections to the point particle approximation, namely finite size effects. So in the new picture, we just have, it's almost Newtonian. We have two particles in a flat space-time, and they move. And the only thing that we have to add is some effective interactions between the fields in space-time at the points of the particles. So the action now becomes something like this. It becomes a function of the trajectories of the two particles, x mu. It becomes a function of the field modes, the potential field modes, which I'm not going to define right now. It becomes a function of the radiation field modes. And there are additional degrees of freedom. There are spin degrees of freedom, which are sometimes denoted by the frame or sometimes by the spin variable. And there are some internal degrees of freedom. So let me discuss briefly each one of these. Okay, the trajectory is familiar from Newtonian physics. The potential modes are the modes which have length scale of the size r, the separation. Namely, these are the modes that live in the system zone. H bar are modes that have a much larger length scale, lambda, the wavelength, and they live in the radiation zone. By the way, both of them have the same time dependence. The time dependence of each one of them is one period, is the duration of one period. But these are on shell, and these are badly off shell. Then we need to incorporate the finite size effects, namely some approximation beyond the point particle. And we need to go to spin. And of course, there was a lot of work in spin, both in traditional methods by Schaefer and in EFT by Porto, Rothstein, Levy, Buonanno, so many people who are here. And I feel that this is not still a done job. At least I still have questions about it, because there is this spin supplementary condition which introduces some gauge, some freedom of choice into the question. And it's not clear why we should need this freedom of choice. And there are some things that are not, don't seem quite tight to my taste, but that remains to be seen. And finally, there are degrees of freedom which live on the black hole. Actually, these are nothing but waves traveling near the horizon of the black hole. From the effective field theory point of view, these are additional degrees of freedom that live on the black hole and are introduced in order to describe dissipation or absorption. From the original general relativistic point of view, these Qs are nothing but near horizon modes of the gravitational field. So if we keep all these modes, and you see from it's not so, you have to be careful to keep all these modes. In quantum field theory, we often just say we integrate out stuff. We integrate out whatever we want. But here we realize that we're allowed to integrate out fields, but we always have to keep the asymptotic fields. So when we integrate out the potential modes, we have to retain the radiation and the modes inside the throats, inside the near horizon. And if we want to integrate out the near part of the radiation modes, then we need to keep the far part of the radiation modes. So there is some, I believe it gives us a bit more finesse what we're allowed to integrate out and what we're not allowed to integrate out. Namely, the things which allow us to use the formula for the evaluation of the action. Finally, there are also finite size effects. So if I now have the action, I should tell you what is the full action. And I don't want to go over all the ingredients. But I will have a point particle action for the trajectory. There will be an Einstein-Hilbert term for the radiation. For the potential fields, it turns out that they're almost static. They're almost time independent because the bodies are moving so slow. And therefore, it's right to do a non-relativistic decomposition where we replace h mu nu by an intuitive set of fields, the non-relativistic gravitational fields, and the Newtonian potential, the gravitational magnetic potential, the gravitomagnetic potential, and finally, the spatial metric. So that's the appropriate decomposition of the gravitational field in the non-relativistic limit applying to the potential mode. It does not apply to other modes, such as radiation modes. And one of the terms here, and when you want to go beyond the point particle approximation, you have to include finite size effects. And this is what Misha will tell us in the continuation of this talk. So I will now skip that. We were able to reproduce the post-Newtonian results one by one. First, Ira and Walter did the 1PN. Then Misha and myself were able to do the same, but with these fields, and thereby slightly reducing the workload by one diagram. But I believe now it's the minimal amount, because you have just four diagrams, which give you just the four terms that you have in the Lagrangian. So I don't think it can be further shortened, or any additional insight can be gained. Then 2PN was done by Gilmore and Ross. And I noticed something very interesting. You see, if you look at Goldberger and Rothstein, then it's GR. Then you look at Gilmore and Ross again. And there is also Ross and Goldberger. So you see that all the interesting works in GR are GR. Okay? According to the alphabetical convention. So they did the 2PN and computing 20-something diagrams. And they had to understand some, of course, new ways also, or new challenges, how to compute the diagrams. They were able to reproduce the traditional results as summarized by the review here by Luc Blanchet. And finally, very recently, about half a year ago, Sturano and Fofa were able to do 3PN, and that was already computerized over 100 diagrams. Even the diagrams were just drawing the diagrams was computerized, and definitely computing them. And there was complete match, which is amazing to me. That means that both works were correct. Okay? And it's very, very complicated. So each one of them had presumably tests of its own to know that it were correct. Of course, the original one was tougher. It's hard to be correct when you're first. But this is wonderful. And now we're trying to push it even further. And I don't know if it's so important in its own sake, but it allows us to understand better the theory when we encounter the challenges in higher PN orders, such as finite size effects, such as renormalization, log effects, and others. And there were other works also on spin effects, which I mentioned. Radiation zone, I just mentioned the work by Walter and Andy. And there are several challenges remaining, as we could see, not only going to higher orders, but there are some things that were not done at all, such as the finite size effects. And I would like to stress that there is one notion which maybe Misha will talk more about, which is the black hole effective action, namely an action that describes a black hole moving in a slowly moving background. So I have now just one black hole. And I want to describe it as it moves in a background which varies much slowly than the size of the black hole. And that's some object, the black hole effective action, which we don't know. It starts as the point particle action, but then there are corrections. And I think that in some sense, it is as fundamental, or it characterized the black hole as much as the Schwarzschild solution. Definitely, if you know the Schwarzschild solution, well, not quite, actually. So what it entails is working on the Schwarzschild solutions, but on perturbations of the Schwarzschild solution, which are not asymptotically flat. So I will not go into detail. I will just mention that this is an important objective to calculate the effective action of a black hole. OK, so let's see how are we doing our time. I have something like 10 minutes. Who's with my chair? What?
Yeah, 10 minutes.
I didn't hear. What did you say before? Okay. You didn't want me to run. No, I don't want to run at all into Misha's time. Okay, so we spent much time, according to the work in the field, on the post-Newtonian case. But I want to mention, at least very briefly, some other very interesting effective field theories that were popping out more or less recently. So the first one was already mentioned. That's the one of the extreme S ratio. And there are challenges from the standard point of view of computing the cell force, doing it efficiently enough so that you can really run a full computer simulation where you would compute the cell force at each moment in time. And this is so far an existing challenge. And one of the other challenges here was to compute the cell force, and that entails some regularization, which in standard GR is rather difficult, and you have to scratch your head rather a lot, while in field theory, you just go ahead to do a dimensional regularization, and you get a finite result, and that's it. So hopefully, these methods will be able to apply, that's my hope, also to that case, and perhaps to simplify or to shed new light or insight on known results and give newer results. Another interesting limit would be to combine post-Newtonian and Embry, namely, take the case where the mass ratio is large and are far away in the adiabatic in spiral case, and there you may have the double power of two small parameters. The next system that I want to mention is the ultra-relativistic or weak ultra-relativistic scattering. So this is a work of mine from this year where we consider two bodies. It could be two wavefronts in gravity, but it could be also in electromagnetism or a scalar theory. And they are shot at each other at the speed of light, or at least ultra-relativistically. And we know that as they will pass each other, there will be a small scattering angle. The small scattering angle is guaranteed by us choosing the impact parameter B to be large enough. So if we give them a large enough impact parameter, then the scattering angle will be small. We have a dimensionless small number, which we can use as a small parameter. Here also, we can relate it to a ratio of, to a hierarchy of scales. And we can develop an interesting effective field theory, which is, I just want to note here how close it is to the post-Newtonian case. Here we get something which is an instantaneous propagator, the same way that we get in post-Newtonian. Only here it involves only the transverse directions. So the propagators are described for us fields that are attached to the nose of the particles. They spread instantaneously and transversely. And we can completely solve this problem by imagining that each particle is carrying on its nose a plane of field lines, and they interact only when they collide. So it is a delta function interaction. It happens only at one moment. And using these tools, we were actually able to gain a new result, to obtain a new result, which is the duration of the interaction. You see, the duration seems to be more instantaneous, zero time. But if you go to higher orders in the perturbation theory, you see, I won't go into the technicalities, but you can see the duration. And we were able to determine it for the first time using this tool. I should mention that this problem was studied in the past by many people, including Toft and Veneziano, under the title of transplanckian scattering. The state of radiation is not done yet. It's not done yet. So that's an open problem. Thank you. So we mentioned black holes and gravitational waves. What about cosmology? So cosmology is another place where EFT methods could apply, and I understand that we'll have talks later in the workshop. Other classical theories are electromagnetism. Chad already described to us an example in electromagnetism. And there are other examples that are closer to string theory. I will just mention very briefly, in view of the time, the ADS holographic renormalization scenario is a classical field theory. the horizon hydrodynamics, the people like Minwala, Strominger, and Oz are working with, things that go back to the membrane paradigm of Thorne and Damour. But today, they apply to horizons which are very thin. So we want to discuss a slice of space-time which is very small compared to the length of variations over the horizon. And people are using exactly these tools of effective field theory, of classical effective field theory there. Another place is in the study of black objects in higher dimensions, such as black folds from the school of Emparan, Oberst, Harmark, and others. And finally, there are also works in two-dimensional field theory here by Ira. So hopefully it will develop to many other new directions. So a short summary before I end. I think the post-Newtonian effective field theory is now beyond its infancy. It's already independent. We know all the basic rules. It can already hunt for itself. It can do work. And there are still some things of interest to do there, but both conceptual and computational, but it's in a very strong shape. I wanted to stress that classical field theory is extremely general. Whenever we have a problem with two length scales which differ by much, then we should use it with all the strength of Feynman diagrams, divergences, loops, renormalization, counterterms, all of these concepts. They should all come up in many, many examples in classical physics. And I look forward to applications also in elasticity, fluidity, I don't know, fractures, all the branches of the classical branches of classical field theory. And finally, I think it also sheds, at least for me, some light on the foundations of a quantum field theory. So with this, I would like to thank you for your attention and hand the chalk to Misha. Yes.
Not reconciling. So Chad was arguing that if you want to do dissipation in effective field theory,
dissipation?
Yeah, if you want to account for dissipation, you have to use the two-path Lagrangian that he described. And I'm under the impression that all the work in effective field theory were, you know, accounting for dissipation without employing that framework. So I guess my question is that true? And if so, you know, how come they did it right? If according to Chad, they were not supposed to get it right.
Okay, I will answer, although probably Chad will want to add something also, but there was already work on dissipation. The work was using the quantum closed-time path formalism. So it was known already somewhat how to use it, but the way this thing was defined was troubling, since again, you had the path integral, you have the factors of I. It wasn't intrinsically classical, and it was clear that there should be an intrinsically classical definition, and this is what Chat supplied today.
Okay.
So would you like to add it?
Yeah, I guess in addition to that, you might be thinking of the, like what Ira, Mahler, Raphael, Andreas have been working on, is computing the post-Newtonian flux, for example, where there is, you can say, it's dissipation. So there
might speak out a little louder, sorry.
Oh, sorry. So in calculating the flux, the way that they've done it is to use a Feynman Greens function. And if you compute the imaginary part of the effective that's related loosely to how many sort of gravitons are produced in the process. And so if you take that, you can then compute the path just by multiplying the action by essentially the wave vector, the momentum.
Okay.
And so that gives you not the instantaneous power, but the time average power, which is more useful for any of that.
And that's distinct from adding terms that we describe radiation reaction.
Yeah, which is instantaneous.
Yeah.
Which
has to be done either. Yeah, okay.
I'd like to understand how, within the effective field theory approach, one can obtain the waveform generated by the binary black hole, for instance. I understand that with the radiation gravitons, you obtain the flux, the total energy loss, but the waveform itself, which is very important for the LIGO detectors. I would like to understand how you get it.
Okay.
The positions.
I think you're asking me because I was the first speaker on the subject. I will explain it, although there are people who actually did the work in the audience and they may again want to add something. So the way it is done is that you first obtain the two-body effective action, which is a function only of the trajectories of the two objects. And this allows you to solve for the motion. So you solve for the motion. Then from the motion, you go to the radiation zone, and you want to find the quadrupoles as a function of time. Not the quadrupoles, but more generally the multiple moments, all of them. This is done by matching. And actually, I'm a bit simplifying, because it's not only going in this way, but there will be also later information going here and affecting that. But to lowest order, that's the way it works. So first, you find the two-body action. You find a solution to the equation of motion. You find the multiple moments. And from the multiple moments, now we can compute the full age. I don't think there is any difference in that sense. You have Q of t, and from that you find age.
OK, so you are computing directly the what we call the radiative multiple moments, which simply are the parameterization of the asymptotic waveform.
I think so. Maybe, I don't know if Walter or somebody wants to add on that. But
Andy will give a whole talk on the subject.
Okay. Oh, wonderful, yes.
But I think that's basically right.
Yeah. So if you go back to your first topic, the classical Feynman diagram expansion.
Yes.
So somehow, as I understand it, you wanted to, at least at three levels, you wanted to get rid of all the eyes. Because
yes.
You say everything should be real. On the other hand, as it was mentioned earlier, when the radiation goes on shell, you expect some imaginary part. In Fourier transform, which is not a problem because Fourier transforms of real functions are complex functions. So,
okay.
So I guess I'm missing the point of getting rid of all the eyes in Fourier transforms. Since eventually, when things go on shell, you get some eyes. So.
Well, we agree that you want all the fields, all the results to be real, right?
In real space.
Yes.
Not in Fourier space.
Yes.
Fourier space, I have no idea whether.
Well, clearly, when I use all the real Feynman rules, then it works.
Off-shell. I mean, when the propagators are off-shell.
The propagators are off-shell, yes.
But if they do go on-shell,
yes.
Then I have classical emission of on-shell radiation.
Well, when they go on-shell, I believe what we should be using is we should be using the classical closed time path formalism. And then, well, I think finally, we agree that in the end, there should be no eyes. So if there are eyes in the Fourier transform, then they should be conjugated in the right way. So
if I may,
I don't know if
so
I can.
The action, once you specify the trajectory of the field, is a number. So no matter if you, because the action is the integrated Lagrangian.
Yes.
So the Lagrangian can be complex, whatever.
Yes.
But once you integrate it, you get a number.
Yes.
When this number is real, then you can be conservative, it's fine.
Yes.
When the number is an imaginary contribution,
yes.
That's the dissipation.
Yes.
And so the imaginary part of the effective action is indeed a sign of dissipation.
Let me say differently. If you want to continue use the eyes, I don't mind. They will not cancel. They will not cancel in the end. But if you want to continue using them, it's okay.
It's going to use the metallic guy.
Yeah, but the metallic guy on shell is also going to have an imaginary part in Fourier space.
In Fourier space, but the only Fourier space will be.
No, I agree with that, but.
No,
I guess what I'm saying is that it's not obvious from his Feynman rules without eyes that there's not going to be any eye in the end because those are off-shell Feynman rules.
Yeah, so I think if you want to calculate the power by taking the imaginary part, then you can't do it.
There should be an analog to any valid computation. So that's one of the things that troubles me. What is the classical analog to this imaginary part? And you're using their Feynman diagram and later the Feynman propagator theory. And later in other papers, you're using a different propagator, right? A retarded. I think in some papers, you use a retarded or somebody uses retarded.
If you use one radiation reaction, you have that power. But if you calculate power, you can always do. matter. You can't combine
it. So you have to have a certain.